picking you up. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Limebach. For those who haven't heard the TechNet in the last 32 years, its main purpose is education. Also, inspiration. There are people out there who have got a lot of enthusiasm about wireless techniques. They want to know how it works and how to make it work better. So those people who have curiosity gather here. And we help them. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. And if that doesn't please you, try one of the other 25 before you give up the hobby. Arguably, this is one of the most educational hobbies there is. The schools, in my opinion, the good electrical engineering schools, do a less than mediocre job of teaching wireless engineering in a useful engineering format. Particularly when it comes to antennas, I think they do a really terrible job. Each one of those schools is making sure that their computer science course is up to date, because that's where the money comes from. That's where students, every high school student says, I want to work with computers and gaming and software writing, and therefore they make sure that that part of the curriculum is up to date. Whereas very few high school students will say, I want to be able to design good radio antennas and transmitters and receivers. Therefore, the schools have no feedback and they don't make any improvement on that. That's a bunch of opinions. People who sign into the TechNet do find out an awful lot about how antennas and transmission lines and propagation and how radio really works. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area. New York City includes northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York State, a good section of Long Island is all covered by this particular repeater. Okay, the very loose format which we have, which we don't always stick to, but we try to, is
repeater timeout.
I hope I haven't dropped out the eastern, but no, I haven't. Good. The very loose format that we try to stick to, but we don't. We're not super regimented, if you know what I mean. Is that from 8 to 9 o'clock? We take general questions of ham radio interest, and we try to give quasi brief answers to those questions. At approximately 9 o'clock, John KC2WGB opens the mailbag for the people who don't yet have the right equipment so that they can sign in and talk to us live. So they send us snail mails, emails, pigeon droppings, and they give us their questions. One of those very interesting questions that we got last week was from a lady who's 8.5 years old named Caroline, who asked a question that you're going to be hearing about where it really started us thinking. And so various people did their homework and gave us the answer on that. We got to take the answers to those homeworks and put it on the Mike number 2 site, KC2NJM. The very next morning, we heard people discussing that particular issue in a slightly different way as to Caroline's question. So people will sign in between by giving me their name, their call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment, for that sign in for the 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock section. As I said, at around 9 o'clock, we go over to the mailbag, and whenever we go through a few of those mailbag responses, we then go over to the space report from Paul, WS2N, our space expert, who will be giving us space report number 111, I think it is. A rough guess on my part. Paul can correct me on that. Let me drop. So, and then beyond that, we go into quite often deeper subjects, more of a physics nature. But that doesn't mean we are not allowed to discuss anything of physics during the first hour. There are people who insist that we try to discuss nothing of physics. Well, what happens if a guy is asking a question about his antenna, and he's asking about a little bit further understanding of how the electrons bounce around on his antenna that he's designing, improving, or correcting, if you know what I mean? From my point of view, that's a perfectly valid question. There are no invalid questions. The invalid question is the one that didn't get answered or didn't get asked because the person was too embarrassed to ask it. There's no such thing as a question that's too dumb, from my point of view. The dumb, so-called dumb question represents the biggest gap between what the guy knows and what he wants to know. Therefore, he's most deserving of an answer, if you know what I mean. The elitist attitude that some people have, that, that question doesn't come up to our level of priority or our level of affluence or our level of sophistication. If that question is too far below us, we're not going to answer it. We don't have that attitude. So give me your call letters, your name, if you've got a question or a comment for the net right now. K2LIW listening.
Go.
I heard also somebody there named Ed. Please give me your call letters and name again.
82 GJE, I have a historical society announcement, over.
Okay, K2GJE with an announcement. I should know your name, K2GJE. Please tell me your name, sir.
Yes.
So, okay, so we've got Tim and Ed so far. Anyone else to sign in because they do have a question, a comment, or an announcement? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2LIW.
K2LIW, yes.
K2LIW,
yes.
And to again, on the call.
Okay, we got KE2EJ, Eric. We got WA2RYY, Joe. And we got Wes. Joe, what's the latest that we can handle your question? Because I know you got to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. What's the latest that you're able to hang in there tonight, Joe? Go ahead.
Probably short of 9 a.m. or 9 p.m., something like that. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, Joe. If we start getting close to 9 p.m., I'll jump over to you no matter who we're handling at that particular time. All right, one last call. Anyone else beyond Tim, Ed, Joe, and Wes to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW. And that was Hal. Will give us the more compact answers when they're appropriate. One last call. Anyone else with any questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Also. Go ahead. Yes, I have a question.
And a space report from WS2N.
I didn't mean to eliminate Eric, of course. There was one other person who just signed in. Please repeat. The last person who signed in, please repeat.
To Mike Bravo, yes.
I might have stumbled. WS2N space report.
We got you, Paul. We got some guy named Mike Bravo. Never heard of him before. One of the biggest moon bouncers in the New York City area, Barry. And I should tell him if he knows something about radio. Okay. Tim, you're number one on the runway, so go right ahead with your question. KD2, Alpha Victor Uniform, K2RIW, my name is Dick. We're listening.
K2RIW, good evening, and then good evening to the net. This is KD2AVU. Yeah, I got a question. Recently, I'm building an antenna tuner. Matching box, which is called the S-Match, which is a Dutch amateur developed this kind of matching unit. It's a primary for a balanced feed line, which is the ladder line, and very simple, just one transform. It's one transformer and one roller inductor or any variable inductor and also a variable capacitor. That's the three main components of the antenna tuning unit. But my question is there any way I can measure the imbalance of the output it just got cut off. Is there any easy way to measure the balance? The current of each output. That's my question. Back to the net.
60 PZ comment.
Okay, Hal apparently has been down that road, and let's see what Hal's got to say. You got it, Hal.
Hey, Dick. Now, if I understand correctly, you want to see how wide the impedance range is of this matching unit?
Negatory. That's not what he's asking, Hal. He's asking, his antenna tuner is the kind that's intended to feed balanced feed line, like 600 ohm or 450 ohm or 300 ohm, so-called open wire feed line. He wants to know how to make a measurement to measure the degree of balance. He's asking, is there any common mode current on that line? K60PZ, K2LIW.
Okay, well, the easiest way is to terminate it and then take an RF probe from the common point to each side and measure the voltage and see if they're equal.
Okay, let's assume now that this is 450-ohm ladder line where the wires are encased in plastic. He's feeding that through his G5 RV antenna, and he wants to know how well balanced it is, and you said he should take a voltmeter. Okay, those are easy sounding words. What kind of a voltmeter? Where is he connected from to? K6DPZ, K2LAW.
And now I wasn't understanding exactly. Alright, what he has to do is take like a 2-ohm resistor, put it on each side of the output before he goes on those ladder lines. Then take an RF probe, measure the voltage drop across each of those resistors. The voltage drop across those resistors can be determined the current going into the line, and he can see if he has balanced current going into his ladder line. I didn't understand his whole question, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, I think we're getting closer and closer to a darn good answer here, Hal. He's got a 1-ohm or a 2-ohm resistor in series with each side of the open wire line, and now he's going to put a voltmeter, of course, in an RF voltmeter, okay? The RF voltmeter has a grounded lead and a hot lead. Whenever he connects the grounded lead to either side of the 2-ohm resistor, he's now putting this great big hunk of hardware called RF voltmeter across that line, and it represents a unknown impedance between it and ground. So I think that's a difficult way to go, and so I'm going to pass it back to you because maybe I've misunderstood. Very few of the RF voltmeters you and I have own a thoroughly differential probe with high impedance on both of those differential probe ends, if you know what I mean, so that doesn't disturb the line. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
Okay, we'll make that a little easier. He takes a diode in series with a microamp meter, and he puts that across that little 1 or 2 ohm carbon resistor. He can read the AC voltage drop across that resistor, which is equal to current. And he wants to look for equal RF currents going on that line, Dick. Now you follow what I mean?
I think we're getting somewhere here, Hal. That sounds like a very viable approach. So he builds a diode rectifier with capacitor across the 1 or 2 ohm resistor. It has its own floating meter, and he does that first on the right side, then on the left side on that floating Dawson valve meter movement. He's not taking something that's plugged into the 110 volt line and taking one of those two leads, one of which is ground, and bringing it over to the resistor. Beautiful. I think you got a good solution there. The only slight variation I would make to that is that if he had an RF scope, which has a dual trace to it, A and a B channel, and if the scope is modern enough that it has an A minus B function, and you take two separate scope probes, one scope probe goes on each end of a single resistor, and now you measure the voltage drop across that resistor with two separate scope probes, where each scope probe has got a 1 megaohm input impedance and a couple of picofarad. That's another way it could be done. And you first do it on the right-hand resistor or the left-hand resistor. That's a good approach. I've got one other possible approach. Let me drop.
Probably have a very simple way here.
Okay, you've got an even more simple way. On the brief answer. Go ahead. Hal, I'm having some fun with you. K6DPZ, glad you're making these contributions. K2LAW.
I'm assuming, Dick, he doesn't have a scope with a differential input. That's why I gave the most simplest way to do it. You only need a diode, a little milliamp meter, a bypass cap across the meter. You don't even, and you just go rectify the voltage right across that resistor, and he has the whole story. There are many more sophisticated ways to do it, but I'm just trying to be simple, cheap, and dirty.
Well done. Another possible approach is to put a piece of coaxial cable, take the center conductor with its insulation, bend it back into a small loop, or maybe a 1-inch diameter loop, and solder the center conductor back onto the shield of the cable. That's a current sensing loop. And now you hold that near the right-hand side and then ultimately near the left-hand side of the open wire line, and therefore you'll be sensing the current, and as long as the spacing is the same, it's only going to have a 95% accuracy, 90% accuracy, but that's good enough. And then the next step beyond that would be to make a slightly larger loop that goes around both leads simultaneously to the twin lead. If the twin lead is truly balanced, and you put a loop of wire around the outside of both twin leads, in the manner that I just described. Because the current flowing in one is exactly balanced by the other, that wire should, going around both should see nothing. So, as I see it, Tim, what I would do in your case is give a good hard look at the physical layout of the antenna tuner itself. If the coil of wire feeding the output coil that's feeding the twin lead, if that is symmetrically located, and if both sides of the two output connectors going to the twin lead, if they have equal capacitance to ground, just by pure physical layout, the antenna tuner would be forced into giving you a darn close to balance. And by the way, the amount of imbalance you could tolerate before something bad, let me drop this. The amount of imbalance you could tolerate before something bad would happen is huge. You'd have to really work at it. If you took your antenna tuner, and you got your two porcelain output connectors that go to your twin lead, and if you put a great big ground lead from one of those to the chassis of the antenna tuner, now you'd really be forcing imbalance. Even in that extreme case, in my opinion, you'd still get 90% of the performance out of your antenna, if you know what I mean. So it's a good academic test that you're going through here, Tim, but when it comes down to the bottom line, if you do all your research, I think you're going to find out you're concerned about a rather minor detail, and you'd have to be doing something pretty hugely wrong before you get in trouble on this one. And so, darn good question, Tim, and I don't think you've got anywhere near as much of a problem as you think you might. KD2, AVU. We've never had that question before, Tim. K2RAW, the Tech Man. Okay, go ahead. Hal wants to make another comment. You got it, Hal.
Depending on the power levels,
no problem. Over.
Pretty fine, Tim. Hal was saying, I'm hearing him on the input, that depending on what power level you're running, it's not likely to be a real problem. And various kinds of RF sensors in the shack would give you a real indication real fast. If the balance had a whole lot.
Go back to the
Somebody wants a repeat. We're going to repeat the address. Don't worry. where? Anybody have any further questions or comments? I'll fill for this one. K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, looks like we got that one pretty well. The next guy who signed in with a question is Eric. Some guy who sometimes doubles as a broadcast engineer. I'm having some fun with Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, K2LAW, K2EJ. I'm going to play dumb for this question, and it's an argument that I'm having with another broadcast engineer. But here's the situation. Okay, we're talking about an FM transmitter deviating at 75 kilohertz. And there is, it's a medium power station, there is a co-channel station not that far away. And the argument is this, and I just want to get your opinion, I know what my opinion is. Now he feels, this guy feels, that if he reduces the modulation, that he's going to offer a margin of protection to the other station that's co-channel. And I want to know what you think about that. We're not dropping the output power, but we're reducing the modulation. How much do you think that would affect a co-channel station? K2RW, K2J.
There's a lot more to that one than first VCI, Eric. If you and I are running narrowband FM, plus or minus 4.5, 5 KC, with a narrowband FM receiver, and you got a co-channel guy there, the presence of a second carrier, because it's never going to be exactly 100% accurate, you're going to hear a continuous tone because of the beat note between the two carriers, and as the modulation takes place, if one of those carriers has a PL tone and the other one doesn't, or even if both of them have a PL tone, those PL tones are never going to be phase locked. This is one of the problems they had in New York City, for instance.
We're talking about FM transmitters, broadcast, not narrowband, wideband.
I know what we're talking about. I'm about to show you that there's a huge difference between narrowband and wideband. In narrowband, you're going to hear the grumble of the two carriers beating against each other. In the case of wideband, because the modulation index by which the receiver is set up, the slight difference in carrier frequency between the two probably will not show up as a tone. The high capture ratio of that receiver will also wipe out the tone. So therefore, you're not going to hear a tone from the other signal. The only thing that comes through from the other signal is the FM modulation, the so-called audio, music, or whatever. And as such, when it comes to the total amount of interference, as long as the offending signal is not so strong that it captures the limiter, you're gonna have a whole funny thing going on here. There's this high capture ratio receiver, which has got cascaded limiters and a super broadband and a medium broadband IF strip with separate limiters, the so-called Dickey fix technique. There's a bunch of variables there, but when it comes to the amount of audio interference, very slowly are you going to get a slight improvement if you lower your modulation index. But the biggest variable is how strong is the individual carriers between the two and where the capturing takes place. And the usual definition of capture is when the carrier, the desirable carrier is stronger than the undesirable carrier, such that after demodulation, with equal modulation, the undesired audio is 20 dB lower. That's one of the definitions of capture ratio. So I think you're going to get a slight improvement, but the amount of improvement is a darn small. I don't think it's worth fighting for. But in this particular case, I think you will not hear a tone in the background. Wideband behaves very differently than narrowband in this area. Bunch of opinions there, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the tech man.
Repeater, timeout.
Alright, K2LIW, K2EJ. Alright, well, that's kind of in the realm in which I was thinking. But, you know, reduction of the modulation, specifically for the modulation complex, not just FM, there's also RCS and a couple other things that are literally on the outside there. The way most FM receivers operate, the stronger carrier wins. I don't give a damn about the modulation. We're really talking about an area in between the two stations, whether or not it's, you know, if I reduce it, say, by 10 kilohertz to 5 kilohertz worth of deviation, give the other station the advantage, would they be able to be heard, you know, X number of miles closer towards not the Coast Channel, it's the originating channel. And really, the end result here is that the FCC designated the area, the service area in which the station is allocated. And according to their rules, you know, you operate at your ERP and your correct GPO and GPS antenna, and you should be fine. So, in essence, if the Coast Channel station wanted to complain, they should be complaining to the FCC, not the other station. No, thank you for that. I didn't see that there would be much of a difference where the other guy swears up and down that it didn't make a big difference. QTRIWK2J.
I vote with you, Eric. I think the difference is very small. Out of curiosity, roughly how many airline miles are there between these two code channel FCC assignments? Sounds to me like somebody didn't do their homework when they issued these licenses in the first place. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
N2EO comment, Vic. K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, let's say there's about 60 miles, 50 miles in that neighborhood. The code channel station that we're talking about is actually, if you want to know, it's WSR. They have a low power booster transmitter and translator. That's low power, and that's a state route, but, you know, that's the case. You know, it's kind of in the realm of what we call low power FM, or community radio, where you may have two stations that are 60 miles apart. In that dead zone, the FCC will license the low power station to cover, say, a 10 mile area.
Yeah, we've got to feel sorry for the poor guy that happens to be living halfway between those two stations, and he wants to listen to one of them. Even with that low power repeater, depending on the exact layout of his house and the line of sight RF path between his antenna and those two stations, life's going to get complicated. I wonder if you run into a situation like this, Rich, in 2EO, some comments, K2RIW, go right ahead.
Vic, not on this subject, but I wanted to say, could you put me down for a question at the very end? We had a late dinner here, and I just got in here, back to that interview. I apologize, but put me at the very end.
You're on the list, Rich. Okay, the next person who signed in, and thank goodness we got to him before it got super late, is Joe, W2RYY. He often asks us these questions that are pretty tough. Go easy with us tonight, Joe. W2RYY, K2LIW.
I'll try to. Okay, Steve Roy White, Joe. I guess you're ready for this one, right? The question I have has to do with squelch and how it works in an FM receiver. In particular, the way it reacts to no modulation compared to width modulation, how you set the squelch will cause sometimes the receiver to actually close the squelch as you start approaching a signal level that's less than 20 dB of quieting. I'm sure you've seen this happen from time to time. Even though you check the receiver and the receiver seems to be working fine, you seem to have good bandwidth symmetry as far as the IF being symmetrical on both sides. It still seems to exhibit this phenomena. You ever seen this happen before? Back to you.
Absolutely, Joe. If you and I were naive electrical engineers designing an FM receiver with a squelch circuit, we probably would look at the automatic volume control or the automatic gain control voltage. If your receiver had one of those, and beyond a certain level of voltage, we'd say squelch is open and squelch is closed. And that would sort of work, and I've seen people do that. With the right kind of integration, you can get sort of operation. However, the people who really study FM demodulator circuits realize that an FM discriminator really is a differentiator. In other words, it favors higher frequencies. The real your ratio or your FM favors higher frequencies. As such, that's the reason why you've got pre-emphasis and de-emphasis as the signal gets weak. And if you have a data audio spectrum analyzer looking at the output of your discriminator as you make the signal weak. What you would discover is that the high frequency noise comes up faster than the low frequency noise as you make the signal weak and you're looking at the output of the discriminator. Therefore, many of the squelch circuits have a separate circuit that has a high pass filter. It looks for the amount of high frequency noise. If the high frequency noise is above a certain amplitude, it says, aha, that must be due to a weak carrier, and it squelches off, it cuts off the audio so that you don't hear a whole lot of noise coming out of the receiver. However, if the FM modulation, the audio you're putting into the microphone circuit, happens to contain high frequency signals, let me pick a number, at around 15 kilohertz, the audio you're putting into the mic can false alarm the squelch detector circuit that's looking for high frequency noise. You're supplying high frequency noise, maybe your music has got some cymbals being played, which has got some high frequency notes. The squelch circuit will hear that and starts cutting off the audio. So you gotta be a little bit careful about the passband of your mic circuit. Does it allow frequencies that include the squelch detector circuit looking for high frequency noise? That's a bunch of opinions. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Now let's see what Hal's got to say on this one. He works on a whole lot of FM circuits with his service monitor. You've got it, Hal.
The only thing I wanted to say, right, the sample high-frequency noise, the high-frequency noise locks off the audio. But also, in certain receivers, what they do, they take limiter voltage. That also, when the limiter voltage is present, it would have the squelch to open up and won't let it lock up. So it samples limiter as well as noise. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Don, good point, Hal. So when you're using a Cadillac receiver, it is looking for high frequency noise and limiter voltage simultaneously. Therefore, when the limiter is showing a lot of action, it knows it's got a strong carrier. Therefore, it allows that circuit to somewhat dominate over the high frequency noise detecting circuit, and therefore, even if your music contains some cymbals, the cymbals are not going to false alarm the squelch circuit if it's simultaneously looking at the limiter voltage. That's a slightly more sophisticated receiver, and hopefully some of the really expensive ones do that. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Don, good question.
I was pretty much talking about commercial receivers, not something that's going to be transmitting music or anything along with the voice modulation. In other words, typically what I see with some receivers, they all seem to react differently. Speaking about commercial ones, above the threshold, maybe. You're a super weak signal. The small circuit at that level.
Yeah, I can tell that you're not using a commercial receiver, Eric. In other words, in your case, it's two-way radios for fire, police, law enforcement, and ham radio purposes. And yes, they might not include the simultaneous circuit of looking at limiter voltage as well as squelch. And I think on many of those, just the high frequency noise coming out of the discriminator is what the squelch circuit is using. So it can easily be false alarmed by being in a noisy environment that has high frequency noise. And there's other, the squelch circuits are never perfect. They've always had some funny characteristics near threshold as I see it, Joe. And I wonder, Joe, are you doing some further research as to the schematic diagram of the receiver and the way the squelch circuit is wired versus these false alarm situations you're running into with that squelch circuit? So I wonder if you have the schematic diagram of those receivers available to you, and if you have one that's got the problem and one that doesn't have the problem, two different brand names or two different model numbers, you may see a difference in the way they determine the squelch. Is it only a one-input squelch circuit or a two-input squelch circuit, which includes a limiter voltage? And there might even be a three-input squelch circuit, if you know what I mean. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
try to, in an attempt to try to get voice modulation out of the picture and not really have that be an issue, but in some cases, it does seem to matter sometimes. I'm pretty much talking about commercial stuff like the Motorola gear, or sometimes some Harris equipment does this kind of stuff also. As far as an exact specific receiver with exact specific diagram, no, I don't have that in front of me right now.
Yeah, I know you don't have that in front of you right now. However, your place of business probably has a department where you can request the manuals, where you can get the schematic diagrams. So I'm guessing that some of the receivers you perform a function on do this squelching more intelligently than others. And it sure would be nice to look at the ultimate schematic diagram of those two and find out why is one more vulnerable to this phony squelch response compared to another. So I'd like to believe somewhere in your place of business they do have a library where those manuals are available. Is that possible, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW.
I could probably get a hold of the schematic of the particular device under, you know, if they have any questions, but it seems in some cases that the base station receivers act a certain way, except, say, you take, like, mobile receivers that are made to work with it, mobile transceivers, they seem to sometimes work a little bit differently sometimes, but I guess that's what I'm going to have to do if I, you know, find some sort of difference or something like that. I'll have to come back and bring it back to the tech man.
Yeah, I think that's one of the next steps of your research, Joe. You're trying to find out what in the world's going wrong or right on the good ones and the bad ones. I'd like to believe the schematic diagram is going to give you a clue. I didn't say it's the easiest way to go. I know in many places like the one you work at, getting a hold of the manual, they'll say, why the hell do you need that? And it's been sitting on the shelf for 3 years. It's got a whole lot of dust on it. We never used the manual. We know what we're doing. You're going to hear words like that. You're going to get a little bit of flack. But you're tough enough, Joe. You can get beyond that. And I think your next level of research here is going to be the schematic diagram. Please come back and let us know what you find out on that one. Now, into moon bounce. How are things going in far rocky way, as you sometimes call it, Barry? And I've got some beautiful tower sections sitting in my backyard. They've got your name on them. They've got this great big label. You know, it's a wired label with a cream-colored tag. It's got your call letters and your name on it, ready to be erected. N2 Moon Bounce, the big erection guy, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Barry.
Anyway, I got two questions. They're very short. One of them is, I'm going to put 4 2-meter beams on an H-frame. They're going to be about 11 feet apart, you know, a big square. I also happen to have a 10-foot parabolic dish. Now, that would be really nice for 432 and 1296. It's handy. It's cheaper than a load of antennas. I want to put that right in the middle of the four antennas. I want your opinion on that, whether you think I'm going to screw everything up doing that, or you think it'll fly. That's question number one. Question number two is, the 4 2-meter beams, they can go to one of these four-way power divider things. Very old. It's made by KLM. It's probably 40 years old. But I just wanted to know, in my opinion, and I think yours too, it doesn't matter what length of coax I use to the power divider, as long as all four lengths are the same. And how do you feel about that, N2MB?
Yeah, you got some darn good questions there, Barry. In the case of the 10-foot dish, and I personally used a 12-foot dish on 432 and 1296, I say, do not do that. with a 12-foot diameter dish on a real good feed horn on 432, I think I measured something in the vicinity of 16 or 17 dB of gain. One good Yagi with 1 or 2 square foot of wind area. With 1 or 2 square foot of wind area, one good Yagi will give you the exact same gain as that great big 12-foot dish. The 10-foot dish in your case, in between those four Yagis, it's going to screw it up royally. Unless...
Israel.
Go back to Israel.
Cut, 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 cut.
You don't have to to your
someone else.
Why did Timber Hill Hill the two Timber Castle from you don't
he's mobile and he's 20 over 9 and 45 degrees.
Element presents is different when it's
fed all by itself or when it's fed as a conglomerate of all of them simultaneously, you'll measure slightly different impedance. I wonder if you've ever heard that one before, Barry. N2 moon bounce, K2RIW in the tech net.
Probably did, but, you know, it was like 30-something years ago, and I probably forgot it. Okay. So, in your opinion, 4RIWs on 432, 4 wherever I got on 1296, and 4 the Aggies on 2 meters, and don't mess with the dish. The dish is going to go in another place then, right?
Yeah, don't put that dish in the middle of that array of Yagis unless you have the ability to put the dish 10 foot behind the mast.
You know I don't.
I know, darn well, you don't. unless you've got the biggest humongous rotator on planet Earth and you're willing to put a great big weather vane out in front of this thing to wind balance it, which, by the way, is doable. With the proper wind load, with a counterweight out in front and a weather vane out in front, believe it or not, you could do that, Barry. You have the resources. I'm not recommending you pour all of your resources into this, but that would be an interesting science project. Tuck that into the back of your brain. Someday, at some crazy frequency like 10 gigs, you can use it. N2 moonbounce. Great question, K2RIW.
I don't want to take up the net. I think there was somebody that had to get out of here by 9 o'clock, so let me stand by for that guy. N2MB, Rockaway. Thanks a lot, Dick.
That guy was Joe, R-I-Y, asking the scratch circuit. He's gotten his service tonight. John and I are going to send him a bill. He got his service. I think I'd go down the... Oh, yeah, Rich is the next guy with a question.
Hal had a comment, Dick.
Hal, sorry about that. Go ahead, Hal. K6DPZ. Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW. You got help.
Hey, Dick. Yeah, my comment was that generally they just don't use carrier squelch anymore. They use suborbital tone with carrier squelch, and you shouldn't have a problem. Once the suborbital tone is present, it's going to open the squelch, and it won't frost any other way.
Yeah, that makes a good sense. When it's got the suborbital tone on output squelch, as I'm going to call it, input squelch, output squelch, you know what I mean. But the squelch on the output, the PL tone on the output of the repeater, and the receiver is set up in such a way that it won't open up the audio until it sees that PL tone. And that PL tone being present simultaneously means there's enough carrier to give the discriminator enough response so it's able to reproduce the PL tone above some particular amplitude, and therefore the circuit works. And have you ever seen any false alarming of receiver PL tone demodulation and squelching? Have you ever seen that circuit false alarm, or do you believe that one works 99.9% of the time, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Back up.
Save your head in the fish. Save your head in the fish.
You don't know the frequency. My name is Sinister.
I guess I'm getting through. This guy is having a grand old time tonight. My goodness. And is he potent? Almost everybody is hearing strong signals. If you're hearing signals that you think shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode on your receiver. Record the amplitude that you heard and the time that you heard it and where you're located. Mobile affix, whatever. Tell us where you were, when it was, how strong the signal was. Please report it to rfi@limoc.org. Radio frequency interference is what RFI stands for. rfi@limoc.org. And we've got a guy that collects those reports, correlates them, and makes sense out of them. And so with that combined with other techniques, help us to locate this very disgruntled and unhappy individual. Okay, so one last time, Hal, I think you did tell me that receiver squelch circuit almost never false alarms. Is that true, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW. Yeah, I'm hearing Hal in the input, and he is saying that, yes, that's not much of a problem, even though he wasn't able to get through. Okay, Rich N2EL, go right ahead with your question, Rich. And even if it gets jammed, I can hear you on the input. You're putting out a nice signal these days, Rich. N2EL, K2LIW.
Okay.
money in Whitestone, and I thank him very much for that. Can't tell me, I can't tell you how much I thank him, but out here, I have my girl living with me, and she wants somebody that is insured. So I have a company called TNT Electronics in Belmore. Is it Belmore? No, Baldwin. They're going to do the job. Did you drop me, Dick?
Yes, sir.
Anyways, I'm in Baldwin. And he told me that the 10-foot mass, I needed 10-foot as opposed to 5-foot because, you know, those radios hanging down. I needed 10-foot mass with the disco. Television antennas are putting up, they're using 5-foot masks. The 10-foot masks are prohibitively expensive. Would you believe Home Depot gets $29 for a 10-foot mask? They're only available through the web if they ship them, and the shipping costs are $55 because it's oversized. The fellow from TNT told me he can get them, but they're also very expensive. What do you think about a piece of inch and a half EMT? And what does EMT stand for? Tubing. And,
Without a doubt, EMT tubing will give you a rust problem if you don't do something to protect it, Rich. And this mask that you want to put up, yeah, the great big shipping charge because of the 10-foot extra length is a bit of a problem. However, I'm a real strong enthusiast of aluminum. There are a number of places on Long Island where you can buy inch and a half, inch and three quarter, 2-inch diameter, or whatever, aluminum tubing of all kinds of diameters. There are places where you can buy used aluminum tubing. Yes, aluminum brand new is kind of expensive, and the dollars per pound, if you know what I mean. But by way of used techniques, and there are hams who collect aluminum in their backyard. I know one of them. and from time to time, they've got chunks of aluminum that are the right diameter, the right length, and the right price. So I would strongly recommend you get a local piece of mast and don't have this not-so-great piece of mast shipped in at a ridiculously high price. So local aluminum, used or brand new, but most likely used, and from a friend, I think is your best approach, Rich. On top of that, your discone antenna, I'm having trouble believing that it's going to be your main transmitting antenna. Let me drop. I'm having trouble believing that's going to be your main transmitting antenna. To be a general coverage DC to light frequency range receiving antenna into your scanner, discone is a beautiful way to go. But when it comes to transmitting, for what you want to do, a collinear antenna for 2 meters and a collinear antenna for 440 is going to give you omnidirectional real gain. And beyond that, you want to be putting up Yagis, in my opinion. Now, no ham has ever got enough antennas. You're going to be adding more antennas downrange. The discone is a good beginning. I'm having trouble believing you're going to be thoroughly satisfied with transmitting with it exclusively, if you know what I mean. You'd like it to be a be-all, end-all antenna for scanning and transmitting. I think the discone is going to slightly disappoint you compared to some of the other things you can put up. Bunch of opinions on my part there, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, the Tech Man. ZHI comment. ZHI recognized. And stand by a minute there, Rich. ZHI, give us your full call and name, sir. K2RIW.
Full sign, kilowatt Charlie 2, Zulu Hotel India, KC2, ZHI, danger is J2, Yankee. I happen to be an electrician. Would definitely recommend using galvanized over aluminum for the strength. Aluminum will bend much easier than the galvanized steel. Galvanized is treated so it's not going to rust on you. Give you a good 20 years without an issue. Just wanted to give a comment.
MDP also recognized. Let me go back to Jay for a minute. Jay, what does EMT stand for since you're in the business? That's one thing. And second of all, you're absolutely right. Using the galvanized on top of the aluminum can give you the strength or inside of it. However, Aluminum, if you use thick enough wool and large enough diameter, the stiffness of aluminum tubing goes up cube lower with diameter. You would think a 1-inch diameter piece of tubing and a 2-inch diameter tubing, that one is 2-to-1 different. There's about an 8-to-1 difference in stiffness. So if you've got the right kind of mounting clamps, that you can put up an 8-inch diameter piece of aluminum, that's going to have all the stiffness in the world you can dream about, in my opinion. What does EMT stand for, Jay? KC2ZHI, K2LIW.